Linoleum Knife is here. We're a podcast about movies. That was Hanson.
The greatest homeschoolers ever.
I would agree with you on that. The greatest homeschoolers ever and the greatest song of the 1990s.
What were you saying today, that it Smells Like Teen Spirit was...
This came up. First of all, I'm having a sense of deja vu that you have played this once before as an intro, and I don't know, but because I'm still...
I don't remember.
I'm still archiving the things, and I haven't come to that episode, if indeed it does exist.
We've been doing this thing for 2.5 years. I can't keep track.
That's why I'm archiving.
So hopefully someone will keep track.
So we can keep track. And if anyone knows the answer to that question, you can tell us. You were doing dishes and listening to this song, and after we danced in the kitchen for a bit, put that image into your mind, listeners. You were talking about how lazily this song was used in The Hangover Part 3.
Right.
And you're right. It was used in a very lazy way, as sort of like a goofy...
Oh, what a nerd.
...joke. You know, oh, he's such a dummy, he listens to Mbop.
Yes.
You know. And it was used brilliantly in last year's movie that very few people saw, Detention.
Right, which is now out on Blu-ray and whatnot. Yeah, which paid due respect to the greatness of Mbop.
By giving...
it its own title card of closing credits.
So, and then you were talking about Smells Like Teen Spirit, which is arguably...
Oh, you brought it up. You
said, arguably the more important song
sure.
of the 90s, but Mbop is the best.
Yes.
Which song do you want to get your tattoo removed from? By, to?
During.
You're during.
Around, about, across.
When you're getting your crappy tramp stamp removed, which song do you want to be listening to ease the pain? Mbop.
You are Dave White, film critic for Movies.com.
Yes, and you are Alonzo Duraldi of TheRap.com and also What the Flick, the television program for movie reviewing on YouTube.
Yes.
That you do with Christy Lemire, who used to be with the AP,
mm-hmm.
but quit.
Yes.
Matt Atchity, maybe someday when he comes back.
We light a candle for his return. He is always welcome. He's been very, very busy of late, apparently.
He's been swamped.
Lately on YouTube, the comments are like, is Matt gone? Is Matt fired? You know, which, as somebody pointed out, weren't you guys the same ones 2 months ago who said that Matt was too whiny and Matt's tastes were too populist? Like,
yes.
You can't win with these people.
No.
But we want Matt back.
And also Ben Mankiewicz.
Yes.
Who had a great birthday party for his significant other lady last night.
Yes.
And they ordered way too much food, and
yes.
we were the beneficiaries
yes.
of that. We came home with a bucket of ribs. And, well, I mean, they're gone now. But
really? All of them?
No, there's like five left. Enough for a little breakfast. Enough for a little pre-breakfast snack in the morning.
This is why you're fat.com.
No, this is why I'm awesome.com. They loaded us up when we left with a plate of grilled veggies and a
beans
big, and baked beans and corn on the cob and a gang of ribs. I really like these people.
Thanks, Ben.
They're good friends. She was loading our arms up with stuff, and he walked through and he said, oh, imagine that, Dave and Alonzo are not saying no to a bunch of ribs to take home. That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
That's right, Flacco. We'll take them off your hands. You're not man enough to put them down. Yeah. We'll handle this.
Look, put me on camera on TCM, and I'll make an effort to lose weight. In the meantime, more ribs, please.
What I love about their neighborhood is the street they live on is so wide. It's like a freeway.
Yeah. Like, it should be lined with palm trees. That's how wide it is.
It is lined with palm trees.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't notice. Oh, well, then there you go.
It's basically Beverly Hills on the far west side.
Right, but the Santa Monica version.
Yeah. It's just such an idyllic sort of neighborhood with this gigantically wide street. Like children could play an entire game of baseball in this street. And probably, cars probably don't drive down it very often.
Probably I mean, not.
Just people just sort of like walking down the sidewalk. There's also really nice sidewalks.
Yeah.
You can have a stroll down. All the houses are well kept.
They aren't all cracked with tree roots.
Yeah.
Now, we're only ever in that neighborhood for fancy...
To go to the Arrow
or for fancy people parties.
Yeah. I wouldn't call them fancy.
They're not, but, you know.
They rented a fancy house.
They're living nice.
They rented a fancy house.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They
are fancy zip code people.
Yeah. So, the movies that we're talking about... What are we talking about?
We're talking about this week is Internship and
oh god,
The Purge and Much Ado About Nothing and Dirty Wars and yeah. We still owe discussions of
Kings we
of
owe Summer.
We owe you.
We owe
we
you.
We promised last time Kings of Summer and Going Places. So,
well, let's get the Internship out of the way.
All right, fine.
It's garbage,
and it's 2 hours long.
Such large portions of garbage that
they could barely contain.
You can enjoy. You talk about this because I'll talk about The Purge.
Fine. Okay. So Vince Vaughn.
Pause it for a sec. I have to cough. I'm coughing.
Okay. Now that you've expectorated. So yeah, Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson.
Having allergies this week. It's a rough allergy week for me.
Really, I hadn't heard you mention it.
You know, I like to keep you updated on my progress. It's important that you know, as my spouse...
I'm kidding. I
all about my health
I, of course,
and my ailments.
Care about your health.
My maladies.
Your roominess.
My rheumatisms. You just calm down.
Anyway, you sup on your hot liquids.
I'm doing it.
And
I'll
talk about this.
Tell everybody the really important plot of the internship.
Yes, it's fascinating. Okay, so Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn get fired from their salesman jobs. Their watch company goes out of business because everybody looks at their phone now. Nobody wears watches. And so...
And they show an old lady looking at her phone to make the point.
Right.
They're like, hey, old lady, what's the time? She's like, I don't know. My phone's in my purse. Mm.
Yeah.
Aha, see, because old ladies. Go on.
So, they, you know, are of course completely useless in the modern job market, but they somehow wangle their way into an internship at Google, even though they don't know anything and are completely underqualified. And, you know, everybody else in the program are these, like, young go-getter, early 20-somethings.
How many other people have applied for these internships?
Thousands, I think.
40,000.
40,000?
Yeah, 40,000 applicants.
Yeah. Somehow these lovable rakes get in. So then, of course...
And it's for college students.
Right. And so they enroll in University of Phoenix just so they can technically be college students.
Yeah.
So then they get to
Google. The joke they make about that is, it's the Harvard of the internet. They make that joke 3 times.
Yeah. Every joke in this
movie... Every time they do it, you can't wait for them to do it 2 more times.
Yeah. Almost every joke is not funny, and almost every joke is repeated 3 times. So then, of course, they get there, and you know, everybody has to divide into teams, and the winning team is guaranteed jobs at Google. So, you know, they
have to participate in all these challenges.
Yeah, these challenges, these competitions.
Like they're all on Big Brother, suddenly.
It's like, you know, they have to, things about coding, and things about salesmanship, and things about, you know, you have to create an app, you know, that sort of thing. And so, of course, nobody wants to be on their team because they're old and
stupid.
And so they get stuck with, like, you know, the reject cast off.
The misfit
the
kids.
The misfits.
Yeah.
The nerds. The slobs v. the snobs.
Right.
And, you know, of course, they all bond and learn important life lessons and blah, 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 blah. Here's the thing. You know when you log into Google and the word Google is in like red and blue and yellow and green and it's sort of this like moment of, you know, primary school, you know, kindergarten color assault. But then
that's my favorite thing.
You click, you know, I'm feeling lucky or whatever, and you get to move on away from that screen. Well, this movie traps your eyes into those colors for the entire movie. Everything at Google is like inanely color-coded to that. So like all the stuff in the building and their bicycles and the everything and it's really...
There's a slide.
Yeah.
There's a tubi slide in the office.
You don't have to go downstairs.
Stairs are for the olds.
That's right. There's a curvy slide. There's nap pods. You know, all the coffee's free. It's, you know, they try to present Google as workers' paradise, you know.
It looks like a gumdrop palace that is also a prison. Here's what I wrote in my notes.
It reminded me of the toy factory in Toys after Michael Gambon takes over.
Right. I wrote it. Here's what I wrote in my notes. I'm reading you directly from my Moleskine. I hate colorful
Yes.
And I don't have time for condescending children. Because basically every kid in this damn movie
has
something snotty to say to...
Our heroes. Like the bad
for
guy.
For no actual reason other than that they are older.
Well,
do you know any young people who actually behave that way?
I think if
I know a bunch of people under 25 who are perfectly decent.
Okay, yeah. But think of it this way. If you're like the smartest wonk in your college and you somehow manage to be one of the lucky few chosen for a Google internship.
Yeah.
And then you look next to you and you see these two loads who clearly don't know, you know, HTML from a JPEG.
I hate them because they're stupid.
Yes. Which is, I think, why people hate them.
Not because they're old. No, they talk about it's their age that they goof on all the time.
But they keep saying things like on the line instead of online.
I'll get to that in a
second. Which makes no sense because these guys are our age and they've been using computers for a while.
Yeah, exactly. That part, I won't get to that because you just said it. These are people who are in their 40s.
Yeah.
Who,
they have been online
like
for
everyone else
years.
On the planet is on the internet. They're on the line.
Yeah, and if they were salesmen,
they're not 85 years old.
And if they were salesmen, like I'm sure they would have had like, you know, PDAs and then Blackberries and then iPhones and all that stuff over the years because those are the tools of the trade.
Yeah.
It's not like they're Fuller brushmen who time warped here from the 1940s.
That's how the movie treats them though.
Yes. It's ridiculous.
Like they're watch retailers.
Right.
You know, and they meet people and they're like, oh, here are my watch display.
As though they were selling Model Ts. I mean, people do sell watches still. It's more of a niche thing, but I mean, you know, there's still a Swatch store at the Beverly Center.
Yeah.
And there's a Chili Beans Hotel or whatever.
I don't know what it's called.
Century
City. It's baffling, whatever it is. What I was getting at with the whole kids thing, the condescending children thing, is that if I were 21, I would be insulted by this movie.
Mm, yeah.
Because it paints young people as the worst human beings alive.
True.
And it paints them as not knowing what they have to look forward to, which is garbage. Seriously.
Well, you know, no, they talk about that.
The movie proves them wrong. The movie takes these kids, lets them say, hey, the world out there is horrible for us. We have nothing to look forward to in terms of the freedom economically that your generation had. And then it proves them wrong.
Then it proves
that if you've got gumption, you can make anything.
I don't think that's true. I think what the movie throws that out there as a reason to why this whole stupid competition matters to them, because they know how hard it is out there, and they need to win this thing to get these jobs, because otherwise they're screwed.
Right.
And so yes, they do. I mean, are we spoiling anything to reveal? Yes, they win the competition.
Yeah.
But you know that I don't think the movie is using that as a way to dismiss their earlier concerns.
Oh yeah, it is. It is absolutely dismissive of those concerns. Absolutely, 100%. Because what the film is really saying is that if you've got pluck and a can-do spirit, it doesn't matter if you don't know anything. It doesn't matter if you're better than everyone else. You can actually be a dumbass and not be better than everyone else, and you can still win because you've got the courage to dream.
I can't believe I'm disagreeing with you on this because we both hate this movie.
You are, because you're wrong.
No, here's the thing. I think the one thing the movie is saying is that while all these other teams have the super bright, super smart kids who can code all the live long day and all that stuff, that it's... If were it just Vaughn and Wilson on their own, they would fail miserably because they don't know anything. But it is their capacity to understand human beings and what people actually want, combined with the nerdtronic math powers of the other misfits, it's together, that's how they win.
I understand that. However, the tone of the film is still really, really anti these kids.
No, I agree with you on that. The kids are portrayed as jerks. No, but I disagree with you on the thing that the movie pretends that it's not true what they say early on about how terrible their economic situation is. They know it is.
That's not what I said. I didn't say the movie's pretending that's not true. The movie is pretending that the way around that horrible situation is to have, you know, pep and pizzazz.
I think a case could be made.
Old-timey adjectives. You should have a lot of those in your life.
I think a case could be made that to survive in the new economy, you have to understand bleeding edge technology, but at the same time, you can't get so lost in the mechanics of it that you miss out on dealing with people. Why are we having an argument over this crap?
It all comes back to Metropolis, doesn't it?
The head and the heart.
The head and the heart
must work together.
Must work together. Here's what we can agree on. This sucks it.
Yeah.
This movie is garbage.
It is directed by the loathsome Sean Levy, who gave us...
Tell us what he has directed, Alonzo.
The Pink Panther remake.
Yes.
Well, you liked Date Night, right?
Ish, yeah, kind of.
The two...
It was fine. Tina Fey,
the hideous Night at the Museum movies.
Yeah.
Real Steel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's the worst. Say what you want about M. Night Shyamalan, but I would much rather sit through any of his... I would rather sit through The Lady in the Water over Night in the Museum 2 any day.
Correct. I really, really...
Much less those Pink Panther remakes.
Oh. What I really loved was the 45-minute strip club scene.
Oh, where they all wear tops?
Where all the dancers wear bras.
Yes.
And
PG-13, ladies and gentlemen.
And Vince Vaughn gives, or Owen Wilson, one of them, I can't remember. I can't tell them apart.
Who knows?
Gives one of the kids advice because he wants to hit on this stripper that he really, really, really likes.
Actually, one of the Google employee they're working with, who seems like he's younger than the college kids.
Yes, and he knows one of the strippers because she came and taught a dance class at Google.
Right.
So he really likes her, and he wants to hit on her.
Trying to work
his pickup lines. And Owen Wilson, or Vince Vaughn, whichever one
I think
it was,
it's Owen Wilson,
says, you know, the most radical move is just to be yourself. How true. That is what we can all
learn from the internship.
From the internship. That it's radical.
Cowabunga.
And by radical, let's just say it's rad. It's rad to be yourself.
And not do drugs.
And stuff.
And be a party dude.
Yeah. Have the courage to dream. You have had the courage to dream, someone says in this film.
God.
And that's what the movie's about. Have the courage to dream. Unlike Wedding Crashers, which I also didn't like.
Yeah.
Unlike Wedding Crashers, these guys aren't supposed to be jerks.
No.
They're supposed to be lovable.
Right.
That makes it even harder to enjoy the film. Because when they're being jerks, at least you can laugh at their jerkiness. They don't even get to be jerks in this movie. They're you know, underdogs. They're lovable, scrappy underdogs.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to get a bone. Trying to make it in this cruel world.
There's a whole...
Trying to take kids to a strip club and leave them there for 45 minutes in real time.
Yeah, that sequence goes on forever.
There's
a whole romantic subplot between Owen Wilson and Rose Byrne that goes nowhere. Except for one minorly amusing
scene. She's a driven career woman who's going to have to choose. Does she want a career or does she want love? She can't have it all. You know why? Because she has a vagina. Ladies, what we're trying to teach you here in this educational film called The Internship, that you should stay home.
Again, I think you're overreading.
And make babies.
Yeah, I think you're overreading.
And cook food in the kitchen
at
the expense of everything else.
No, that's not what the movie is saying.
Isn't it?
I know.
What is Rose Byrne's character? This is the best of everything 2013 for Rose Byrne.
No, Rose Byrne's character has forfeited romantic entanglements in favor of her career.
Yes, yes.
But now she's getting the full court press from Mr. Owen Wilson and his nose, and finds herself, you know, unable to resist them.
Yeah.
Again, don't make me defend this stupid movie. I just think you're reading too much
into I'm not reading too much into it at all. This is a trope of the ages.
Well, it's not like she quits her job at the end so she can go take care.
No, she doesn't. They just disappear her. Seriously, don't they? She barely has... And after they go to dinner and he woos her...
Right.
And kisses her...
Yeah.
The end of her.
They're done with it.
The end of her. She might as well not exist anymore. She functions to be something that he can acquire along with a job.
Right. Another thing to win.
Yeah. So, ladies, this movie has another special message for you. Honestly, this film is puke awful.
Yeah.
I told Christy, you know, I was having this conversation with Christy the other night. She goes, how'd you like the... Because she sat right next to me in the screening. We had a nice bro seat, you and me.
Yes.
Okay, it's the fat seat, but
it's where the ghost of our good intentions sits between us.
Christy is petite, and she, you know, she doesn't
sidled right in.
She sidled right in. She sat next to me, and then later that night, we were at the Purge together. She and I. She's like, "How'd you like the internship?" I said, "It made me want to kill myself." She goes, "Oh, it wasn't that bad." I said, "Yes, it was." Now, it didn't make me want to kill myself. It made me want to kill everyone who made the film. Pause it again. I have to cough again. What I really should say is that she didn't say it wasn't that bad. I said that I thought it made Google look like the worst place to work on Earth.
Oh, right.
And she thought they made it look really attractive. Mm. But that's only if you're attracted to things like that. Yeah, I don't like that kind of thing.
It's funny.
I don't want the threat of people forcing me to play volleyball at any given moment during my day.
Having just seen The East and the Source Family and Ticket to Heaven, there is something sort of culty about it, the whole googliness thing. And everybody's always playing volleyball or, you know,
Do you want that kind of thing around you? Do you want a life to be a constant pep rally? That's really what it makes it look like it is.
I think I'd rather work at J-Pod.
I would, that's fake. And I, you know what I want? You know where I want to work?
Where?
At this desk, alone, without anyone bothering me.
I want to work
forever.
I want to work at WJM-TV with Mary and Murray and Lou.
Well, yeah, you're already Murray.
Oh, really?
You're the Murray.
Oh, you think you're the Lou?
I'm the Georgette, I think, sometimes. Maybe the Sue-Ann. I don't think I'm the Lou.
Okay. Because you're not. Just checking. But I will, yes, I will. I'll be the Murray. That's fine.
I'm not the Mary.
No.
Maybe I'm the Rhoda.
You might be the Rhoda.
I could be the Rhoda.
You could be the Rhoda.
Why are we talking about
this? I don't know. Anyway, tell us about The Purge, which I did not see.
The Purge is...
which is a big, big hit movie.
The Purge is about the future where there's no crime and there's no employment. I mean, there's no unemployment. There's 1% unemployment and minimal crime. And it's because somehow, some way, we have a new government with these people who are called the New Founding Fathers, although you never see them. You never hear who they are, what they've done. But they have taken over. And they have instituted a policy of no... I guess they just made everyone agree not to commit crimes and do things. It's like Stepford in a way, where everyone is sort of like...
Real chill.
Wide-eyed religious mania, patriotism, but also calm and peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
One night a year... from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m., something called the Purge happens.
Right.
And it is a time of national catharsis when everyone is allowed to do anything they want. All manner of crime and violence is condoned and legal, including murder. And so Ethan Hawke and Lena Headey are a well-to-do couple. He sells very expensive security systems, and they live in a fancy neighborhood, and everybody has the same kind of security system that turns your house into one giant panic room. It's a fortress.
Right.
You turn your house into a fortress. So for those 12 hours, you lock yourself away from the world. Nothing can get in. You think. And the world rages chaotically outside.
Apparently this was the premise of a Star Trek episode. People are taking great glee in pointing out as though that mattered. But
okay, great. I'm just
saying, you know.
Whatever. That's awesome. Star Trek was an innovator. This is not set in space.
No.
It is set in the world of 2022, 9 years from now. No explanation is given as to how the social services deal with this night of chaos. All police, all emergency services are shut down for the duration of the purge. But my question was, what happens at 7 o'clock in the morning? Like, are there waiting lists at funeral homes now? You know, is there...
It's like Black Friday. Is it triage? They prepare for it.
Is it triage at the hospital time? Like, who gets to be treated for their wounds?
They send out Harvey Keitel Pulp Fiction to clean up all the crime scenes.
I guess, you know. Who sweeps the corpses off your driveway and sandblasts the blood out of it? You know, because at the end of this movie, there's a whole lot of dead bodies in this neighborhood. Mm. And they're just all lying on the ground. And so,
some equivalent of the truck that comes down our street twice a week with the brushes.
Collect the, to street, sweep the streets.
Yes.
Yeah, street, like the Soylent Green, bulldozer that picks up all the people.
Right. Yeah. A big Zamboni.
Yeah. And the, so, the purge starts and Ethan Hawke and Lena Headey and their two kids are in the house, and a panicked homeless man is screaming in the street, "Please help me." The son takes pity on the guy, detaches the security system, and lets him in the house. You got to pause it again. Okay, so I'm back. I was coughing. Did you go back or did you?
No.
You just cut it. All right.
You said.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary for you to cut out the part where I say, "Go away, I have to cough."
All right.
You know. So,
add it to the drinking game, people.
I don't have bad allergies every week. This is just a bad week. So, chaos ensues. I won't give away what happens next. But people come to the house looking for the homeless guy. And they say to Ethan Hawke, you know, little pig, let me in. Mm. If you don't let us in, we'll get in. Mm. And then it becomes a battle. And this movie, every once in a while...
How did your irrational hatred of Ethan Hawke figure into things?
Oh, I should have made that more clear last time. My irrational hatred of Ethan Hawke doesn't extend to the new horror movie Ethan Hawke.
Ah, I see.
Because he was great and sinister, and he's cool in this movie too. And again, I think where my old irrational hate of Ethan Hawke comes from is films where I'm supposed to really be into him as a romantic lead, or, you know, the hero of something that, you know, he's young and bright-eyed and wants to, you know...
You're supposed to want Winona Ryder to go off with him and not with Ben Stiller?
Exactly, exactly. And I remember watching Reality Bites thinking, they're both dicks, don't...
Go off with Janine Garofalo.
Go hang with Janine Garofalo. You don't need any of these guys. So it's a battle movie. It's a battle movie, and every once in a while, the film pretends like it's commenting on something about society, man. You know, it's like, well, it's the future, so technically this is science fiction, and we're commenting on the violence in America, or the guns that everyone has, or, you know, the systematic elimination of the poor through, you know, public policies and
incarceration.
Incarceration and murders and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Don't be fooled.
The movie does not care about these things. The movie cares about Lena Headey kicking ass, tiger momming her way through this, you know,
night of horror.
This night of horror. And if you like her in Game of Thrones, you're going to really like her here. Because that's, she, well, I won't tell you.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't see it, but, you know, this movie apparently was made super on the cheap. It's produced by the guy that did the Paranormal Activity movies and Insidious and Sinister, and it apparently grossed more than its budget just on the Thursday midnight shows.
Well, good for that.
So, here's why. There will be a Purge 2 coming your way.
It is a fun movie. I won't say it's a good film, but it's fun. Mm-hmm. It's effective. And it's got a nice sense of sustained dread.
Uh-huh.
And some fun jolts.
Yeah.
And some cool killings. And you are sort of genuinely afraid of some of the stuff that's happening in the movie. It's just, it's, you know, it's kind of dumb. But it had a good time. And I'm hoping that in Purge 2, which is obviously going to happen.
Right.
I hope they explode it so that it isn't all just taking place in one house. Because
the idea of the
this Purge, is a nationwide thing, and they have
been like an interesting one.
You very could, coy about explaining how it got them to be that way, who enforces it, how the people are so reserved 364 other nights out of the year.
You could explore the mechanics of this.
I want to know how it actually works in the real world.
Right.
It's obviously they didn't think that through for this one. They just wanted to, you know, tell a dirty kind of, you know, home invasion story.
Sure. Well, they can always go back and retrofit it now.
Yeah. I mean, they have a whole year because you know they're going to put another one on here. Yeah. They have a whole year to figure out what is the mythology of this place.
Right.
What kind of America exists in 2022 that this could really be a thing? It couldn't. But I had a good time. And it should be seen at a drive-in.
Well, that was the big mainstream movie of the weekend, and then the big indie movie of the weekend, as far as, you know, per screen average goes, was Joss Whedon's
Shakespeare in Love.
Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing, which he shot on the cheap in 12 days in his house.
It looks more like his getaway lake house is what it looks like.
It
doesn't look like where he lives.
Apparently, it is where he lives.
That's his housey house?
Yeah. I mean, look at it. It's on a block with a bunch of other houses. I don't think that's like
it's on a lake, isn't it?
No, it's a big pool.
Oh, I see. Whatever. Yeah. Looks like a lake. It's a really big pool.
Yeah. So it's Much Ado About Nothing. It's the Shakespeare comedy about the headstrong woman and resolute bachelor.
Wait, if that's his house, then Joss Whedon has the most boring taste in furniture in the whole world.
We were going to get to that. I think, in my review, I said, look, if you wanted to hide the nice stuff because you had, you know, crew members trooping through your house, no one would blame you for that.
Right.
But, you know, they should have art directed it better because the house.
Looks like one of those model.
Yes,
like a model show houses.
Yeah, it's a Crate and Barrel.
Yeah.
It's like one of those fake rooms at Crate and Barrel, but a whole house of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the classic Shakespeare comedy. Kenneth Branagh made a movie of it about 20 years ago. And apparently this grew out of this thing that Whedon likes to do with his buddy actors from his various TV and movie projects, where they would come over to his house and have, like, Shakespeare readings, and they would sit down and read through a play.
Oh, they do that for fun?
Apparently so, yeah. And so then he decided...
No, they don't.
That's what I'm told.
Who told you this?
It's been in interviews and stuff.
Was it the friend of the friend who's actually in the film? Did he tell you this?
No, somebody else.
All right.
And so, anyway, so apparently this is a thing that he's been sort of kicking around for a while, and so this was his follow-up to making, you know, one of the highest-grossing films of all time.
Right.
Low-budget Shakespeare movie, which, on paper, I very much support. You know, absolutely. Make
go Shakespeare.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, make a big epic for them, and then make a very personal, you know, fun thing for you. Lovely.
That was a free cough that you all got. Just, you know.
But... unfortunately, I wish, as a thing for you that you're doing because it's a passion project, whatever, that it had been better.
Everybody likes it except you and me.
I know. The reviews have been really good.
The reviews are really good. And you and I are sort of like...
it's making wheelbarrows of money.
We both must have been in a bad mood.
No, I don't think so.
Were we having a fight?
No.
When we went to that movie? I don't think we were.
I don't think we were. Here's the thing. Alexis Denisov, is that the guy's name?
Apparently everyone loves him, too.
Yeah, okay.
I think he's the... the bee's knees and the cat's pajamas and the...
23 Skidoo. Yeah. I never watched Angel, so I have never seen this guy before. I don't know anything about him. But he's awful. I'm sorry. He's awful as Benedict. And
I like how exclaiming you are. He's awful. You're a bad person.
it's a terrible performance.
You call me lady?
And Amy Acker, who apparently was also on Angel.
She's good.
She's really good.
She's cracking it out.
Yeah, she is like, she's bopping out the bon mot, you know, as Beatrice.
Beatrice.
But boy, her Benedict is just not remotely up to snuff. And so it throws the whole movie off. So that's a big problem. The other problem, not only is the house super boring.
Right.
It's shot in the least interesting black and white I think I've ever seen in a feature film.
Pretty much.
I understand digital, you don't get the same, you know, grain or shadow or whatever that you get with film, but it's just...
then shoot on film.
Either that or do something with the lighting. I mean, there has to be a way to make a better looking black and white digital movie, because this thing literally just looks like somebody flicked the switch from color to black and white, and that was it.
Like, it looks like those... photos that come with the frame that you buy at Aaron Brothers.
or if you take an Instagram picture and you run it through the black and white filter, you know,
right.
it's not interesting looking at all. So that sucked. There are good things about it. Amy Acker, like I said, very charming, very funny. Clark Gregg is in it, and he's good as Leonardo, I think is his name.
Yes, he's Leonardo.
Nathan Fillion as Dogberry and Tom Lank as Virgis are a riot.
They're both really funny.
You know, I always thought that was a little...
although the police station that they're in...
it's clearly the basement of the house.
It's clearly the basement of the house. Like, you have to go upstairs. There are no windows. To go upstairs to get in and out. And it's like, oh, this is where Joss Whedon keeps all of his remaindered Firefly DVDs.
Yeah,
like, there's no...
the cops operate out of the kitchen in Downton Abbey, basically.
Yeah.
But whatever, you know, it's, you know, they're really funny. Like, I thought that was rather overplayed in the Branna version. I remember it was Michael Keaton, right, as Dogberry?
I forget.
Anyway, I seem to, that you know, that you can go too buffoonish and too broad with that. You know, it's one of those Shakespeare characters. But
he seems annoyed. Like, his Dogberry is just sort of annoyed.
Yeah, it's exasperated that not everyone understands how
awesome
he is.
No one's given me my due.
Right.
That kind of
thing. So it's a lot of fun. And frankly, as I was watching, I was thinking Nathan Fillion would have been a great Benedict.
I can agree with you on that.
You know, for me, that was a big mistake. Obviously, it's just us. Because, yeah, on the tomato meter, I think it's in the high 80s.
I didn't hate it. I just didn't like it.
I was very disappointed by it, you know.
It was, I will say that I think it's a little better than it is bad.
Okay.
There's more good about it than there are bad things about it.
It's just that one of the bad things about it
is so glaring.
And integral to the whole movie.
I'm going to agree with you about Denisov. I just did not like him as Benedict.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine this Beatrice even wanting to be near him.
Right.
He
doesn't. The Shakespeare is a challenge for the modern actor to enunciate and, you know, declare. And Acker makes that all sound very organic. She gets the rhythms of the language. She makes it sound like it's actually something that she is saying in the moment. And Denisov is wrestling it to the ground, trying to get his tongue around it.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So. Like, Jaden Smith would have been an interesting choice for Benedict. That would have been all right.
Woof. Okay.
Did you just woof at me?
Not that. Not in that way.
Yeah.
It was more of a, like...
How am I to tell the difference?
It was more of a Fletch woof. And then I saw Dirty Wars.
And I did not.
Which is a documentary...
I'm going to take a little break.
It's a documentary about the writing of the book of the same name by Jeremy Scahill, who is a legendary investigative journalist. He's the guy, he writes for The Nation. He broke the whole Blackwater story during the Iraq War. You know, you see him...
I've seen him many times on television panel shows that are on MSNBC that you... watch nonstop every Saturday and Sunday morning.
Yeah, no, I've seen him on Maddow, I've seen him on Up, and you know, he's a very smart guy, knows his stuff, good writer. You know, I take nothing away from Jeremy Scahill when I say that this movie is unfortunately too much about Jeremy Scahill and not enough about the very interesting story that he is uncovering here about this basically sort of secret branch of the army, which at the time he began doing the research was completely secret. And then, of course, it's JSOC who was involved in the whole capture and killing of Osama bin Laden. So now we know who they are. But when he started trying to dig up information about who was doing these clandestine raids in Afghanistan and killing not just targets.
Is it clandestine or clandestine?
I think you can be either. Moleskine.
I don't know.
Clandestine. Mm-hmm. Clandestine, either way. Raids that were not only taking out the targets, but also, you know, women and children. You know, there's a really... It's a powerful piece of journalism, and the movie captures this really amazing story. But the movie captures the story as we watch Scahill capture the story. So every time there's an interview with some tearful Yemeni or Afghani person talking about a missile strike or some horrible thing that happened, we cut back to Jeremy Scahill with furrowed brow. Jeremy Scahill nods. Jeremy Scahill looks concerned. Jeremy Scahill writes in his pad. And it takes the focus away from where it's supposed to be, and it really bugged me. Again, I'm in the minority. The reviews have been really good. People are raving about this movie, but I have no beef with the storytelling. It's not like I have some political agenda that's anti-Scahill. I'm a big fan of his. But it reminded me of, do you remember that Mystery Science Theater Oscar special one year? It was the year the Quiz Show came out. And they apparently had some sort of like B-roll, and it was all footage of Robert Redford on the set of Quiz Show directing the movie.
Okay.
And they would cut to it every so often because Crow would say something like, I just can't get enough of watching Robert Redford direct. And this movie can't get enough of watching Jeremy Scahill journalism, you know.
Here's what I hope is in my fantasy, Jeremy Scahill is like this awful, you know, career-driven, sort of everybody out of my way kind of guy, like where he's just browbeating the director. Put more me in this movie.
I'm the star. There's only one star of a Jeremy Scahill picture, and that's me, baby.
That's kind of, I mean, because you know that's, I mean, you know he's not like
that. No, probably not.
I've seen him so many times on all of your favorite news analysts'
yes.
programs. And he's, you know, he seems like this kind of really awesome, serious-minded, straight-shooter guy. But the movie that you're describing sounds like he's, like, cracking the whip on, you know.
In the editing room. More me!
Make my eyes bluer. Make them sparkle.
Well, it just, you know,
make them sparkle.
It's funny because I just watched Anchorman, and it reminded me of those old local news opening credits where, you know, like, you know, with Pulitzer Prize winner, you know, Johnny Fontainebleau, and you know, and Johnny Fontainebleau is, you know, laughing with firemen, and then he's sitting at his typewriter, clack, 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 and then he's, you know, nodding gravely at a city council meeting. Like, that's what this movie is.
Well, now I can't wait to see it. I was going to blow it off, but now I'm excited.
And thank, it's funny because I, you know, after writing it, I've had a few people very much on the DL be like, oh my God, I thought it was just me.
I don't want to say anything bad about it, but just.
It's like that with the childhood friends.
Yeah, childhood friends.
Of Kim Song-un.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Okay, Kings of Summer, which is still in theaters, and I think might have gone.
Yeah, it's more than still in theaters. It's doing pretty well.
Oh, is
it's
it good?
Opening okay. wider and all okay. that stuff. Yeah, so it might even be opening in your town soon or this week.
Yes, if it's not already there. It screened at Sundance this year under the name Toys House, but they decided that was hard to say, which it kind of is. So they changed it to the Kings of Summer, and. First feature film from a guy who's got a lot of like TV and Funny or Die stuff behind him. It's the first feature, and I think the screenwriter's first feature.
And I think so too.
It's about these teenagers who are fed up with their home lives. Not that anything particularly bad is going on, but one of them, his father is a widow, played by Nick Offerman, who is just not doing a very good job of being a widow and taking care of his son, who is still upset about losing his mother. Right. And the other one has. Sort of obsessively, you know,
controlling
and attentive parents. His mother's played by Megan Mullally. I forget who plays the dad. And so they decide they find this little undisturbed patch of the woods that somehow folds time and space because it doesn't seem to be very far away, but no one can find it.
Yeah, and it's close to a Boston market.
Yes, and so they build a house. I mean, and it's not just like a shack. It's pretty ambitious.
It's a functional house. It's
multi-level, and you know,
it
doesn't have.
They like do it in the space of like 3 weeks.
Yeah,
all Johnny Cash, like one piece at a time. You know, they just pilfer things from here and from there, and that's. Sure, you couldn't build a birdhouse 5 minutes ago, but
now somehow
you're
and you know, and it's a That Summer That Changed Everything movie, and I was entertained throughout. I mean, it's
funny. It's a funny movie.
Yeah, in retrospect, it's maybe a little too sort of sitcom in terms of not just the sort of lack of realism, but just in the pacing and the joke you know.
Right.
But the jokes are good, and I was amused. I had a good time with it. You know, there's a third kid who joins them who's this sort of weird, sort of non sequitur spouting, machete wielding dude that they don't really know. But
he's the Napoleon Dynamite kid.
Kind of, yeah, and he kind of attaches himself to things. And you know, the three kids all have done TV stuff. One was on Hannah Montana, one was on The Big C, and one was on some other Disney show. You know, it's perfectly pleasant. I in my review on The Wrap, I said it was basically if you want summer escapism without a summer blockbuster. You know, it's a movie that will
right.
it goes down easy. You'll have fun watching it. It's not great. It's not a sort any kind of significant coming of age movie, but it's you know it is utterly entertaining.
I mostly had a hard time with the idea that these kids had. What are you doing? What are you doing making the noises?
I was finishing
the
my
drinking
water.
Noises.
I wasn't eating.
Well, it's close enough.
No, it's not.
I had a hard time with these kids and what they were angry about, what they were rebelling against, you know, other than simply, I have to assert my independence.
Yeah, I'm 15. That's all you have to have.
There's nothing wrong in their lives other than that one of them did, in fact, you know, lose his mother. You know, all the kids in this movie are. They're good looking. Mm-hmm. They're well taken care of. They're sexually confident, which is not real. And
they've got very clear complexions.
They've got actually no problems. I mean, like one of them, the main kid is supposed to be a freshman, just finishing his freshman year. But you look at this kid and you're like, well, by the time you're a junior, you're going to run the school. Just look at you, you know, and then the cute girl wants you, you know, I had a hard time mustering sympathy for the kids.
I don't know that the movie is expecting
And the movie does want you to be on their side.
Well, to be on their side, but I think the movie isn't trying to pretend that something horrible is happening to them.
Well,
they're just annoyed.
They are painted as something of a beleaguered class.
You think?
Yeah. Yeah, by their parents, and what they when one of them gets pranked at school by the big football dude.
They're supposed to be sort of outcasty, which
yeah.
is granted a little harder
and, vibe. And that's fine and dandy if your movie is about that. And I just said dandy, by the way. If your movie's about that and you explore it deeply, like The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which is not a comedy really, but has funny elements in it, and really gets that stuff right in the John Hughesian sense.
Sure. Yeah, this is no Perks. This is no Moonrise Kingdom.
This doesn't do that.
It's very slight. I argue none of that. But what it does in terms of just being funny and being breezy and entertaining, I think it does very well.
You're breezy and entertaining.
Thank you. I'm breezy like Sunday morning.
Sure. Yes.
So anyway, this is not a work.
Couldn't agree more with you about that.
This is not a work of art, but it's fun.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's fine. What is a work of art is Bertrand Blier's 1974 Going Places.
Holy crap.
We saw in CineFamily kicking off a month-long Blier retrospective, and he's a director I like a lot, and so I'm psyched they're doing it. There's even some other movies of his that I've never seen that I wish they were showing, but I'm very pumped to see what they've got.
So these two rapists...
But they're so charming!
Yeah... These two young dirtbags.
Scallywags.
Dirtbags. played by Gerard Depardieu. And
Patrick Dewaere.
Yeah. Who would again eventually re-team in Blier's Get Out Your Handkerchiefs.
Right, which I think was an Oscar nominee for Best Foreign Film.
Yeah.
Dewaere would go on to star in Blier's Beau-Père before dying in the 80s, I think.
Yeah, he died youngish.
Yeah, and then Depardieu would also appear in Buffet Froid and Ménage.
Right. So these two dirtbag rapists are, you know...
shambling their way through France.
They are depicted in this film the way that Rita Tushingham and Lynn Redgrave are shown, you know, jauntily walking down the boulevard in Smashing Time. Like, they haven't a care in the world. They are grimy as hell.
They are freewheeling.
They are the real epitome of freewheeling.
Yes.
If freewheeling is defined by you as also being a person who sexually assaults people.
Yes.
In this case. They bounce from place to place. They steal whatever they can.
They break into
everything.
Yeah.
They steal a car, most significantly at the beginning of the film. And while I've called them rapists, they are really more like almost rapists, because here's what happens. You got to pause it again. Are we back? Okay. The women, everyone from, you know, like this terrified older woman to Miu Miu, who plays, you know, the woman who becomes their sort of
concubine,
Wendy, in a way, like their mother confessor or something, right. You know, they cooperate. And in Miu Miu's case, she becomes sort of, you know, part of the gang.
Yeah, a willing accomplice.
And then there's the woman on the bus.
Right.
The woman on the train that they...
Who's breastfeeding.
Who's breastfeeding their baby and her baby, and then they do not good things to her. But she, by the end of it, she's into it.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre. And they move along through their, you know... pillaging, and eventually come to teenage Isabelle
Huppert. Oh, no, you skipped Jean Moreau.
Then there's Jean Moreau. Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to skip Jean Moreau.
Who has just gotten out of prison, and they figure that she's going to be horny, so they take her out.
They take her, and
take her shopping.
Turns out she is real horny and wants a 3G.
Mm-hmm.
And then a horrible thing happens. And then they wind up with teenage Isabelle Huppert, who also wants to be taken away on a joyride. Because
she can't stand her parents.
And she hates her parents, and she wants to...
lose her virginity.
Lose her virginity to two dirtbag rapists. They... It's weird. They're these characters who use and overpower women because they can.
Right.
They take what they want because bourgeois society needs to be dismantled and you know, property is theft and all that kind of thing.
At least they aren't hypocrites.
At least they aren't hypocrites, blah, blah, blah. So they're these petty criminal thugs. They're outside of the bourgeoisie. But they maintain their big, hulking, muscular dude privilege, and they benefit what they benefit from what was at that time truly a rape culture. Like, people talk about rape culture now as a thing.
Yeah.
It's a sort of becoming a thing that people are discussing more and more, but 1973 France apparently was a free-for-all of this, and either women didn't care, they were too scared to say anything about it, so they just played along. I don't know,
and it's and you're not even entirely sure, like, if the movie is presenting this as, isn't this horrible or isn't this funny or
it's a comedy.
It is a comedy, sorts. But yeah. It's not entirely condoning them, but it's not entirely condemning them either.
Depardieu even rapes Patrick Duerre.
Oh yeah, that's true.
When he feels like it, and tells him after it's over, it's okay between friends. There was no woman around. I had to take your butt. Seriously, that happens. You don't see it happen.
Yeah.
But it's tossed off as this sort of like, oh, it's just a thing that I got to do it. Look, just give me your butt. I need to stick it somewhere. So I'm gonna rape you. You're my friend, and we're co-criminals together, but you're fixing to get raped. Is it okay? Oh, darn it. Why'd you do that to me? Why are you raping me all the time, Gerard Depardieu? Go find yourself Miu Miu. She's willing. So it's strange. Like, the movie's on their side, but it's also on the side of Miu Miu.
Yeah.
And Huppert.
Yeah.
And Jean Moreau.
Yeah. It's an interesting film.
She has a brief performance, like I said, with a very shocking conclusion.
Right.
And that conclusion, that thing that happens to Jean Moreau, it adds this whole other level, this whole other tough level of perversion.
And horror.
Considering what comes quickly after that when they meet Jean Moreau's son.
Right, and sort of take him in.
And take him in as, and like, then, their buddy. And you think to the... And they never say a word about what they did with or to her
right.
His mother.
And then he goes off in this other weird direction, and hey, it's
just, here's the thing.
It's an amazing movie.
It's full of contradictions.
Yeah.
Intentional contradictions. Bertrand Blier knows what he's doing.
It's based on his novel.
Yeah. It's alternately funny and silly and offensive and shocking. It's on their side, like I said before, but it also is sort of
critiquing
them and making fun of them.
Yeah.
Because it's about these guys who think they know how the world works, and they think they've got whatever power they've got.
Yeah.
But they learn that they don't. And yeah. Miu Miu helps teach them.
Yeah, I mean,
that they don't.
It's really the women, in a way, have a power that they're never going to understand and are always going to be.
Which is completely sexist.
Subject to. It's bizarre, but it's...
They lash out against this sort of thing powerlessly and comically.
Right.
Meanwhile, the film ends, if you're paying a very close attention, the film ends with them...
With their own sins coming back.
With their own sins coming back to them that you will never see happen.
Right.
You're not going to see the consequences, but you know they're coming because of some very specific things that they do.
Yeah.
It's never all one thing or the other. Jonathan Rosenbaum, one of the critics that I respect and read as often as I can, he called it repulsively misogynistic.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, like he apparently couldn't hate it enough.
I see.
But then again, Gone with the Wind is repulsively racist.
I should have dug up Pauline Kael. I didn't know, you know, Danny Peary.
And so it is repulsively misogynistic? I mean, it is, right? I mean, on some level.
But is it a film about misogyny? You know, that's
right.
That's where it gets into
It could never be made today.
No. Yeah, there's that chunk of the 70s
fascinating
where
movie.
You could make Blazing Saddles and you could make Going Places and other films that today you would never, ever, ever get to do.
So if you've never seen it, find it.
Yeah, check it out.
If
you have thoughts on it,
you will not have an opinion when you're done. We're still trying to sort it out.
Yeah, and I'd seen it before, but you know, I was like in college, and now I'm really
all just washing over you.
I'm kind of processing it in a whole different way. Yeah. I think when I first saw it, I was like, oh, well, it's French, you know.
Who can figure them out?
What, they do that sort of thing. I don't know.
They do all these bizarre things in France, and no one minds.
Yeah. If you have thoughts on Going Places or anything else, obviously drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. So that's the movies. What's your DVD this week?
Today in Los Angeles, it is Gay Pride Day.
Yes.
We stayed inside and ate all those ribs.
Rib pride.
But my DVD recommendation of the week is something that is currently streaming on Netflix that even if you are not gay, you should watch. You should watch Paris is Burning.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk about one aspect of Paris is Burning, very specifically, as it relates to current slang usage among today's people.
Go on.
If you are around anyone young and or gay, or not even young and gay, maybe anyone who just happens to have seen Paris is Burning, because it's got this whole resurgence going on right now. It's a film from 1990.
Winner of the Best Documentary Grand Jury Prize at Sundance.
But has had it's currently experiencing a kind of revival among...
Well, because of RuPaul's Drag Race?
Because of RuPaul's Drag Race, I think, and also because of the fact that it is so widely available now, streaming everywhere, especially on Netflix.
Gotcha.
There's a term used in Paris is Burning called realness.
Yes.
And it's meant to describe faking something so well that you appear to be real.
That you are passing.
And in the film, it has everything to do with, do you look like enough like a woman to pass as a woman?
Or do you look enough like an executive?
Or in the drag balls that the film documents, do you look enough like, you know, a corporate executive? Do you look enough like a military officer? Yeah. Do you look enough like
a prep school student?
Could you convincingly walk down the street in your costume and have people think that you are the thing you are presenting as real?
Because the people that are doing it are not executives, are not students, are not in the military. They are impoverished, black,
and Latino
female impersonators for the most part.
Yeah. So
so when they use the term
realness,
like you are serving up,
you're serving executive realness, right, means you look like you just could work for
On Wall Street,
Merrill Lynch.
Yeah.
But here's what's happening in the world right now.
On the Facebook
and the Instagram and the everywhere else. I'm seeing pictures of people posting their photos of their meals. For example, tacos. I'm about to have taco realness, they say, as they post their picture of tacos. And here's the thing. No, you are just going to have tacos.
That's
not taco realness. If
you were having tofu tacos, you could say that they were serving up, you know, meat, ground beef realness.
Yeah. If perhaps your tacos were made of Play-Doh and yet looked immaculately like real tacos.
That would be taco realness.
Taco realness. But you can't post a picture of tacos and say that you're having taco realness. Stop doing this if you are guilty of it.
And tell your friends.
I know some of you are.
Call your friends out on it. It's got to stop.
Some of you are doing this wrong. I know you are.
Also, Dave's new drag name is Taco Realness.
I hadn't readied my outfit yet. And I wish you had not given that spoiler away. About my life.
Were you going to dress as a taco like you were handing out flyers in front of a restaurant?
Yes.
I'll say, I've said too much.
You just ruined the surprise for everybody. Me and my taco. I've worked a long time on my taco costume. Got the lettuce just right. The glistening chunks of salsa.
Oh, speaking of tacos.
Yeah.
I had my first Cool Ranch taco at Taco Bell this week.
You're gross.
It was so good.
No.
It was so good.
No.
I was.
Have you learned nothing from our new Gwyneth Paltrow cookbook?
Apparently not. I was doing it as an experiment.
That book's changing my whole life.
I was doing it as an experiment. I just thought, you know, oh, what is this? This is, you know, it was like when I had the, what was the thing at KFC for a while that the...
I don't know. I don't eat at KFC. You're the grosso that loves KFC.
It was a chicken sandwich that was, the bun was chicken. Remember that moment?
Something.
The whatever that was. I thought this would be a similar sort of like, oh my God, what is this? It's really good.
No, it's not.
Have you had one?
No, and I'm not going to have
shush.
One.
Then you and Gwyneth can go enjoy your soy triste. Soy tristesse.
Listen, there was a Taco Bell across from my mom's nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
And at least once during that week, I would drive through and get some quick, you know, lunch. And I got the first Doritos Locos taco.
Yeah, the nachos. Not as good.
And
I had one of those.
Awful.
Too. Not as good.
It was awful.
It doesn't work. The Cool Ranch.
No, I'm not trying it.
The Cool Ranch.
I'm not doing it.
Works.
I'm not doing it.
Listeners, back me up on this.
I'm not even doing Taco Bell anymore.
Back me up on this.
So, yeah.
The Cool Ranch taco.
After recently reading about all the meat terribleness that's going on in the country,
uh-huh.
That report that got filed, that government report, and I got to dig it up again and find it. I'm terrified of all the meat now. Yeah.
You look for things to be afraid of.
No, they just find me. I mean, Richard Ramirez is dead.
Yes, but all the meat
so
has been
to
touched
worry about
by
it.
The strangers.
All the meat. The strangers are killing all, are ruining the meat. Yeah.
So Paris is Burning is your...
Yes,
your,
what's yours?
My DVD pick this week is a documentary that you and I have discussed on this program called Labor of Love.
Oh, yeah. Well, we saw this.
At Cinefamily. It's always Cinefamily.
Yeah.
And it's a documentary that was made on the set of a 1973?
I don't remember what year. It was the 70s. I don't remember
yeah.
what year.
Anyway, they were trying to make an adult movie independently with a non-professional cast in Chicago.
Yeah.
And it's just a documentary of the difficulty of the exercise and how it didn't quite come off.
Right.
But it's a fascinating movie in the genre of movies about how films are made.
Yeah.
And it's really compelling, and you know, I just remember being really fascinating, and it's coming out on DVD for the first time this week.
Yeah. The film that they make bears little resemblance to what you think of as pornography.
Yeah.
They were actually making a little independent adult film with sex in it.
Right. This was the era when like couples would go see X-rated
yeah.
movies and
yeah.
they'd have plots and stuff.
Would you like to have me read letters?
If you can do so without hacking, I'll read.
Well, I'll do it until I can't do it.
Okay.
All right. This is from Steven. He submitted a top 10 list earlier.
Uh huh.
Now he wants to give us his favorite French films.
Ooh la la.
Yeah. Here they are. Number one. He goes from 10 to 1. I'll go from 1 to 10.
Okay.
Number one, Le Samurai.
Okay.
Just terrific.
Yeah.
Number two, Amelie.
Mm.
Which I really like.
Yeah, it's adorable.
Adorable. Yeah. Number three, Last Year at Marienbad. Baroque. Lugubre.
We're the only people who turned Last Year at Marienbad into a call and response, Rocky Horror style screening.
I love Last Year at Marienbad.
It's amazing.
It's a trippy movie. Le Cercle Rouge.
Le Cercle Rouge.
Yeah.
Yes.
The Wages of Fear.
Oh,
which
yeah.
is amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
The Intouchables. No thanks.
No. No.
Army of Shadows.
Yeah, okay.
Leon.
Yes.
A Prophet, which is really good. Did you see that?
Yeah. They're making a U.S. remake.
What?
They just announced they're doing a U.S. remake.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm sure they are.
Yes. I don't know if they'll finish.
I don't like it when they remake French films in America. They never get it right.
The only one that leaps to mind is I like Cousins.
It's okay.
It's not as good as Cousin Cousine. Yeah, no, but it's not. But it's not awful, which most American remakes of French films are flat out awful.
I mean, yeah, there's Three Men and a Little Lady. I think we can
Three Men and a Baby.
We can all get behind that. Yeah. And number 10 is a film I hate, La Haine.
Oh.
I really despise that.
Yeah, no, I never saw it because you hated it so much.
I remember watching it in the 90s and thinking, I'm sorry, he has a gun?
In France?
That's the thing? A young man has a gun.
And that guy is the guy Anomaly, right? Matthew Kasovitz, who made that movie and starred in it? Yeah. He's the dude Anomaly?
You're going to make me go IMDb right now or something.
I'm not making you do anything.
I'm drawing a blank.
I'll do it. But anyway, so I think that's a very solid 80%.
Yeah.
Because seriously, Intouchables...
What is 80% in French?
80. No. Yeah, 80.
What's knife in French?
Is it couteau or something?
Come on.
You took French class in high school.
Yeah, and you got us through 36 hours in Paris pretty well.
I never had to ask for a knife. I think it's couteau.
All right, so say it in French.
Vous êtes 80%. I don't know if it's person. Vous êtes 80 couteau.
You're ruining everything.
Sorry.
My favorite French movies are Vivre sa vie, Weekend, Au Hussard Balthazar, The Wages of Fear.
You're just everything by Jacques Rivette.
All the Bressons.
Playtime.
Playtime. Yeah. Diabolique. Mm. Yeah.
I love Cousin. Yes, Matthew Kasovitz is the guy Anomaly, and he's the La Haine guy.
Okay.
La Haine.
Hi, David Alonso. When you read the movies I hate list a few weeks ago, I thought it sounded like it might be fun, and a few movies came to mind, but after that, I really started having trouble thinking of movies I actually hate, as opposed to movies I just didn't like. I could only come up with 7. I realized that, unlike you, I don't have to see movies I'm not interested in, and I tend to forget movies I don't like. But these movies I remember actively hating, and these are in order. Number 7, Titanic.
Oh.
I like the first 45 minutes and the last 45 minutes. It's the 6 hours in between I hate. As good as it gets.
Ugh.
I didn't hate this while I was watching, but the more I thought about it, the more I grew to hate it. As you think about it, you lose all respect for the Helen Hunt character because only a total masochist would put up with Nicholson. And what kind of idiot would leave their beloved little dog with such a nasty person?
I hated that movie. And I was a big James L. Brooks fan up to that point.
Yeah.
I even, you know, actually, was that before or after I'll Do Anything?
After.
Yeah, I even defend the butchered I'll Do Anything, but, ooh.
You'll like this one. Do Lovely.
It stinks.
Kevin Kline would have been great casting for Cole Porter if they had cast Susan Sarandon as Linda, and I hated the treatment of his homosexuality as just an unfortunate problem in their otherwise perfect relationship. I think the real relationship of the Porters was far more interesting than this.
Oh, no doubt. It's funny, because what really bugged me in that movie was there's a scene where they walk out of a screening of Night and Day, which was the Warner Brothers sort of Baudelaireized, you know, biopic of Porter while he's still alive, kind of rolling their eyes at it. And I'm thinking, Glass House.
Right. Number 4, Baby Boom.
I never quite figured out the affection for that movie.
This smug movie, as most of Nancy Myers' grown-up movies seem to me, almost made me hate Diane Keaton.
It really wants to take her down, that movie.
You've Got Mail.
Ugh.
I have to admit, this movie was killed for me because Meg Ryan went on the Today Show and said she liked AOL because she enjoys languaging.
This is one of those moments where it's too bad it's not a video podcast, because Dave does a really funny impersonation of Meg Ryan typing with intent.
I do. It's my best impersonation.
It's a very good one.
My best celebrity impersonation is of Meg Ryan typing.
Yes.
In You've Got Mail. Kissing Jessica Stein.
Ew.
Dude, you're on it. We hate all these movies, too.
Except Titanic.
The central character is so annoying. My partner says he could actually feel me wince every time she spoke. Guess who she is in real life? take a guess. You know who she is.
It's Jessica Westfeld, John Hamm's main squeeze.
Yeah. The next best thing.
Ew.
Unfortunately, this has the honor of being John Schlesinger's last movie.
I know.
It killed Rupert Everett's rise after his triumph in My Best Friend's Wedding and started him towards being a very bitter man. The characters in this movie are completely repellent, and the idea of them reproducing sends shivers up my spine. Right again.
Yes.
Your list is, okay, you say 90% knife because of the Titanic.
Yes. Thing.
You like Titanic a whole lot more than
well, I do. Well, actually, he only did, you know, he did 7 and not 10, so that throws the numbers off. So let's say taking off my half for Titanic, that's still 93% knife.
Anyway, that letter was from Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel.
And this one is from Ben. Dear Alonzo and Dave, I was reading the blog for one of the local alt weeklies, and Bobby Roberts, who used to be a radio DJ and now hosts a podcast with other former radio hosts, used a lead about pass holes and screening rats. Pause it for a minute. I have to cough again. I'm sorry. I'm nearly at my end here.
Yeah, okay.
Having never heard of these people before, I had to click through to the links. I know LA is, he puts this in quotes, Movie Town USA.
Yes, it's on all the billboards.
And you go to a lot of screenings at studios themselves, but you also reference local theaters a lot. Do you have to deal with these people? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, not all the time. Not
now, in terms of deal, by deal with them,
be in the same room with them.
Yeah,
and not
sometimes that's bad enough.
But I'll tell you, we would have to deal with a lot more if we lived in Dallas or Atlanta.
Yeah, we would.
Because I think they have fewer just critic screenings
there. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They just shove them in with
We're
them.
Very lucky yeah. in that we get to go to screenings where it's just critics.
Yeah, I think regional critics probably have to do a lot more because the studios aren't going to pay for an extra screening for them, so they just take the 5 or 10 or however many local critics they have to deal with and just shove them in with...
A good 50% of the time we are in rooms that are small and just with other film critics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, I don't want to be super sneery about it because, you know...
No, I'm not going to be sneery about it at all because sometimes you get to see the lady with the fried chicken in her purse.
Well, there is that.
She's amazing.
And certainly, you know, when I was younger and broker and didn't have access to screenings, I would go get those passes, too. I wanted to see stuff. But you do start to see a pattern of people who just... go see everything because it's free and they can get it. And they do not always behave particularly well, and they can be...
They never behave well.
They can be a horror.
They don't behave well.
And also you get people who have decided that because they've gotten into a movie for free, they certainly shouldn't have to pay for a sitter.
Right. So they got to bring that baby.
They got to bring the yowling child with them
bring the crying kid.
A thoroughly inappropriate film.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can be a drag. But... you know, I don't begrudge anyone the chance to get to see a free movie if they aren't in the industry.
Right. All right, my voice is over for this show. I'm done.
You're through.
I'm done with talking for the rest of the day.
Well, we thank you, as always, for listening. Come back next week because it's a biggie. The Man of Steel opens, as does This Is the End, and we'll have other fun things to talk about as well. In the meantime, check out our friends in the podcast universe, The Comedy Couch with Dennis Hensley and Tony Tripoli. If you're a Sirius XM subscriber, check out Popcorn Mafia. Sorry, that's not yet. I still have Popcorn Mafia written down.
Popcorn Mafia.
If you have Sirius XM Radio, check out Rotten Tomatoes Radio on Tuesdays and Thursdays, co-hosted by our friend Gray Drake, who used to host the Popcorn Mafia podcast. Cooking with Malcolm Ingram, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Throwing Shade, Team Jack, once again, that was a lot of fun to go on. We were there recently, and we've been getting a lot of new listeners from our Team Jack episode. So thank you all for joining us. If that's how
thanks
you found
for
us.
Not hating us.
Yes, we hope you haven't ditched us yet. The Schmoes Know, the B Movies Podcast, Film Spotting SVU, Podcrash, Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free on iTunes, and if you want to leave us a review there, so much the better. You can stream us at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com. Please like our Linoleum Knife podcast page on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. Check into the show at GetGlue.com. And always, you can drop us a line with your top 10 list, worst 10 list, questions, comments, thoughts about going places,
anything. Effusive praise.
Effusive praise, also welcome. At LinoleumPodcast, all one word, at gmail.com. So, yes. It's been lovely sharing this time with you.
De-lovely.
De-lovely. Really? It's been de-lovely. Absolutely. And we will see you next time.
Goodbye.